So the title of tonight's lecture is, "But Who Do They Say I Am?" Considering Jesus in the Gospels that did not make it into the New Testament. And I want to start with a well-known quote or phrase that C.S. Lewis said in his book Mere Christianity. It's quite well known, and it deserves to be well known. And he says, anyone who comes across the life of Christ as it's narrated in the four Gospels has to come to one of three conclusions. Jesus is, maybe you've heard this before, Jesus is either a liar, a lunatic, or he's Lord. He says, those are your three options. And I think Lewis is really onto something. It's a great point. But since Lewis has written, he wrote that book, the talks that turned into that book were given around World War II. But since then, the goalposts on who Jesus is have potentially widened a little bit. The game has changed. Since Lewis wrote that, archaeologists and scholars, people dealing with antiquities, have uncovered more Gospels. You can see it's made it onto the cover of Time magazine, The Lost Gospels. This is a fragment of one of them that's called the Apocryphon of John. And so there's lots of them, and they go by different names, and I brought a few books here that sort of show some of the different names. Sometimes they're called Apocryphal Gospels, and apocryphal is a fancy word that just means hidden writings or secret writings. Sometimes they're called non-canonical gospels. And the non part, I think, is obvious. But canonical just means it's in reference to the New Testament canon. So they're called non-canonical because they didn't make it into the gospel. Sometimes they're called lost. It gives you the idea that someone maybe misplaced them or threw them away. And then sometimes they're called Gnostic Gospels. And Gnosticism is, if you get into some of this literature, it becomes a highly debated term. But broadly speaking, Gnosticism is an ancient and modern form of spirituality that is predicated on receiving secret knowledge. And the word Gnosticism comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means to know or having knowledge. So it's a spirituality that's very kind of esoteric. It's for spiritually elite people. And it usually denigrates the physical world and elevates the spiritual world. So anyway, these Gospels that have all kind of been uncovered since Lewis wrote make it seem as though the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are now just four options from a whole bunch of many options. And this raises all sorts of questions. What about these other Gospels? Did we get the right Gospels? Did we get the best Gospels, the most interesting Gospels? And how did we get these Gospels? How did we end up with the ones that we got? And that final question of how we ended up with the ones we got, the answer to that, when you often read about these other Gospels in some of these various collections of apocryphal Gospels, or here's another one, Lost Scriptures, when you read about them, they're often presented with this story, or I would say more likely a conspiracy, of how we ended up with the Gospels that we did. And it goes something like this. In the ancient world, in the first couple hundred years of Christianity, before the church was really established and had political power, late 300s, 400s, Christianity was made up of all these really diverse groups. And all these diverse groups had their own systems of belief, their own theological convictions, but they all got along really happily. They were all having big potlucks and rubbing each other's shoulders, and everything was like honky-dory and peachy-keen. And each one of these groups had their own sort of collections of spiritual writings or scriptures. They had their own gospels. So all of the gospels we found have been connected to one of these groups. And then the story goes something like this. The group that really likes Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which we now know as the four gospels that are in the Bible that constitute Christian orthodoxy, that group sort of basically was a bully to all the other groups. And they beat up all the other groups, and they destroyed their gospels, and they forced them to conform to the standard of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they kicked out all the other Gospels. That's really it, kind of that's kind of the story in a nutshell, speaking broadly. And
for clarity,
I'm going to say more eventually, but
I want to know what you said.
What did I say?
Did you say that story that you came up with? That's a modern.
It's a good thing to clarify, to have clarity on. When they write about these Gospels or present these Gospels, it comes with this story, this conspiracy, that early Christianity, no dogma, no distinct theological convictions. Everybody, it was sort of like a choose-your-own-adventure, choose-your-own-Jesus. You could have whatever you wanted, and it was fine. Until this one group of Christians came along.
And that's a modern story.
This is the modern story that's told. So when you hear about this, you hear this story.
Is that universally told with these?
No. I'm going to say a little bit more. And we'll try to save questions for the end, because I get easily off track myself. But the first thing I want to do tonight is just give an overview of what some of these Gospels look like. There's a lot of them. You're going to see that there's a whole bunch of them. And so I'm just going to jump in. Before I do that, actually, I'm going to say where we found them and when we found them. And by we, I wasn't actually there. You were actually there. But in 1945, two Oxford archaeologists discovered in a place in Egypt called Nag Hammadi, so this is Egypt, and it's sort of central, it's over here, they found in a cave, in these big jars, there's actually conflicting stories. It's hard to get to the exact details right. But what they did find was they found all these bound codexes, they found all these old papyrus that were bound in leather, and they all were these what they purported to be were these Gospels. And so they all come from Egypt, they all come from this part of Egypt in particular, the Nag Hammadi. And these are some of them, Nag Hammadi Gospels. And so the ones, and there's two more charts, two more slides of charts coming. So there's a lot. Don't worry if you don't get it all. I just sort of want to show you how many there are. But the ones that are in yellow, this lovely mustard yellow, are ones that we'll kind of be jumping into a little bit later. So you have a Gospel of Truth, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, Gospel of the Egyptians, Gospel of Mary. And what I want to point out is, when we know where they come from Egypt. There's a little bit of debate with the Gospel of Thomas. They come from Egypt, and they're all 2nd century. That means they're coming after Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have been written. They come later. And in a lot of ways, they presuppose familiarity with the story that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John each tell, each one of their portraits. So, and that's significant. They come later, they come from Egypt, and then you can see they're all sort of different. So the Gospel of Thomas is a collection of 114 sayings that are pretty esoteric, and there's no real rhyme or reason to the order of the sayings, and it's just, and Jesus said, and Jesus said, and Jesus said, and Jesus said. Some of the other ones have Jesus telling parables. On this page, the only one that we have a full copy of that we think is the Gospel of Thomas. These other ones exist just in partial manuscripts. We don't even have the entirety of what's going on. And then we have some Gospels that claim to be apostolic. So the Gospel of Judas, which is the most sort of recently discovered one. It came out in 2007. Again, from Egypt, late 2nd century. And the difference with the Gospel of Judas, I mean, there's lots of differences. You'll hear some of it later. It's a very interesting document. But in this story, Judas, get this, is the hero. Judas is the good guy in the story. And Judas receives special secret knowledge from Jesus that none of the other disciples get. And really, it's secret knowledge. It has to do with sort of celestial hierarchies and the creation of the world and all sorts of interesting things. There's other ones that are like this, the Gospel of Matthias, that are mentioned by early Christian historians that we haven't found. Almost none of these Gospels came as a big surprise, by the way. We've known they all, at some point, were in existence because early church leaders would say things like, There's this Gospel of Peter. It's kind of funky. Don't look at it. Don't waste your time with it. We don't believe it's true. So, which leads right into the Gospel of Peter, which is a fragment text that we have, and it's possibly part of a larger one, and it gives this really interesting story. Where the Gospels are silent, which is what the resurrection looked like, the Gospel of Peter gives this very fanciful idea. And what happens is the stone is rolled away from the tomb, and these two men come out of the tomb, and they're carrying Jesus. But they're all three of them are so tall that their heads are in the clouds. And then they kind of leave. And then out of the tomb comes a cross. The cross walks out of the tomb, and a voice from heaven asks the cross, have you gone to preach to those souls in Hades? And the cross says, yes, I have. So in this one, you have a walking, talking cross, which is a very interesting thing. Then we have some other ones, but we won't deal with those. You have a genre called infancy gospels. There's an infancy gospel of Thomas, where it Jesus goes around. It tells stories, again, where the Gospels in the Bible are generally silent on this issue. These Gospels tell stories about Jesus' childhood. They fill in those missing years. They deal with what Mary was like before she was encountered by the angel. But the infancy Gospel of Thomas is interesting because when Jesus is in it, and he's this like little brat, he's this terrorizer, and if you mess with him, he strikes you dead, or he'll strike you blind. So he's really different, but he's really smart. He debates with teachers, and then there's these dialogues of the risen Jesus. You can see some of these. We move into 3rd century. This one moves into the 7th century. So these are all later, and primarily they come from Egypt. They tell very, very different stories. Oops, got a little ahead of myself. Very, very different stories. And there's more Gospels that people have uncovered. Interestingly enough, some of these documents don't refer to themselves as Gospels, but people have given them titles of Gospels. But again, all of this just, one scholar says this. He says about this sort of time period. He says, whoever wanted to write a gospel could and often did. He goes on to say that there was a sea of multiple gospels in the first few centuries, and that gospels were breeding like rabbits, which is, clearly hyperbolic. It's an interesting statement to hear from a scholar because he says whoever wanted to write a gospel could, but most people in the first couple centuries weren't literate, so they probably couldn't write. And also to get papyrus, to get ink, were very expensive. There wasn't, you couldn't tweet off a gospel in the first century. And so it's people who had money and people who were educated. So it wasn't really anybody could write a gospel. But it begs the question, if there was a sea of gospels that the church was maybe drowning in, how did we go from all of these gospels to 4? And why 4? Why not just 1? 1 would be a lot easier. All other kind of religious communities have like one story. Why do we have 4? I'm not going to answer all those questions, by the way. Richard Dawkins writes this. He said in his book, The God Delusion. So this is, there's popular answers to this question, there's scholarly answers to this question, but they all sort of, again, work with that picture of early Christianity where all the Gospels were equal until this one group showed up. So I'm just going to show it up and said, no, ours are. So Richard Dawkins says this. He says, the 4 Gospels that made it into the official canon were chosen more or less arbitrarily out of a larger sample of at least a dozen, including the Gospels of Thomas, Peter, Nicodemus, Philip, Bartholomew, and Mary Magdalene. It's interesting that he, it does make me wonder if he's read these Gospels, because the Gospel of, it's not called the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, it's called the Gospel of Mary. It's clear it's about the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, but it's not called that. So it's just, it's an interesting thing to notice. And James Robinson, who's who is a scholar in who is writing about something he knows about, but he still says this. He says, when Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas were written, there was no New Testament canon, and hence no distinction between canonical and non-canonical. They stood on equal footing, and it was only gradually that some were elevated into canonical status and others were not. So again, you see that when people are talking about these Gospels, they paint a picture that the early church, again, everybody just accepted everyone else's legitimate spirituality and their Gospels. The writing here is a little smaller. This comes from Bart Ehrman, who is one of the strongest voices for this picture of early Christianity. And he says, and I underline group because that just, again, emphasizes that each gospel or group of gospels were connected to a Christian community, he says. But he says, in brief, one of the competing groups in Christianity succeeded in overwhelming all the others. This group gained more converts than its opponents and managed to relegate all its competitors to the margins. This group became orthodox, and once it had sealed its victory over all of its opponents, it rewrote the history of the engagement, claiming that it had always been the majority opinion of Christianity, and that its views had always been the views of the apostolic churches and of the apostles, and that its creeds were rooted directly in the teachings of Jesus. The books that it accepted as scripture proved the point, for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all tell the story as the proto-orthodox had grown accustomed to hearing it. So, again, they're telling a story that in the early church, lots of Gospels, lots of Jesuses, and everybody was fine about it until this one group who Ehrman tags as the proto-orthodox, which means they were sort of orthodox before orthodoxy became orthodoxy, if that makes sense. They came along and snubbed out all of these other options. They snubbed out all these other Gospels and said, we only need four. And actually, Bart Ehrman makes an astounding claim about this group of Christians that enforced, that he says he claims enforced their view of the four Gospels. He said this group of Christians that we know were being hunted down by the Roman Empire, they were being martyred, they were suffering for their faith. He said they invented intolerance. So he puts the blame of intolerance, which is kind of the most capital of postmodern sins, if we even believe in sins, to be intolerant. He places that historically at the feet of Orthodox Christianity. And so I think that gives this is a picture that's painted of the early church that stands in contrast to how the early church has always told, the church has always told its story. And sometimes this view presents itself as cutting-edge scholarship. It's been around for a couple hundred years, though. It started in Germany with a guy named Walter Bauer, who he actually kind of had this hypothesis before these other Gospels had been unearthed, before we'd actually read them. And then it was sort of indigenized in North America, actually right down the road at Harvard Divinity School through a guy named Helmut Koester and some of his students. Maybe you've heard of Elaine Pagels. She's written a lot on the Gospel of Thomas. In particular, and then of course the guy we mentioned, Bart Ehrman. And to respond adequately to this picture, it covers a lot of ground. It covers a lot of names and dates and places and numbers of texts. It becomes very, very cumbersome, and it's not actually what I want to get into tonight. I feel like if we spend a little bit of time looking at the content of some of these Gospels, the claim that they all stood on equal footing is becomes very, very difficult to believe. But I want to say two things in response to this theory that the four Gospels and the group of Christians that enforced them were intolerant, and prior to that, Christianity was this kind of form of religion that really looks like modern-day, individualistic, late capitalistic, spiritual but not religious type people. I want to say two things in response to it. The first is the question on why did this group of Christians insist on four Gospels? And if you're not familiar, these are old images and then sort of redone images that are that were put on the front of collections of four Gospels. And each one of these symbols represents one of the Gospel writers. And it represents, it's highlighting the fact that each Gospel is a portrait. They're telling one story of the same person, but they're doing it in four different distinct ways. So Matthew is a human. He is his gospel. There's a lot more teaching that happens in five sections. So he's the new teacher of Israel, five sections corresponding to Moses, five books of the Torah. Luke, Jesus is presented as a sacrifice, like the bull being brought before the altar. Mark is the lion. Mark comes charging around. Mark is like super fast, moving, not as slow as some of the other gospels. And then John is an eagle. John is sort of is flying above. It's a little more theological. But it seems as though if this group that invented intolerance and had no time for any difference, it's very peculiar that they would settle on four books, and four books that are four different portraits. And in the early church, there's this guy named Tatian who wrote something called the Diatessaron, and the Diatessaron was making a harmony of these four books, which was for him a little less embarrassing, having one harmony of all four stories instead of four separate stories. And ultimately, churches just didn't read it. They were like, no, we want the four Gospels. So it doesn't answer the question on if this group is driven by an agenda of intolerance, why do they have four Gospels? But I think also more interesting, and maybe more makes that the view I was saying people are presenting about early Christianity more difficult to believe, is sort of the facts we have on the ground and what we know about the early church. So I mentioned this is a map of the Roman Empire, and I have this arrow here that's somewhere close to where the Nag Hammadi actually is. And we know these other Gospels were come from here. We know that they originated there. We know that they were used there. But we have no other historical record of them being read or used regularly throughout the rest of the empire. But what we do know about Egypt is even before Christianity came to Egypt, and this is a quote, it's distinguished from other provinces within the Roman Empire so far as we can judge by the early dominance of Gnosticism. And then other scholars have talked about how Egypt was just sort of a breeding ground for folk religion and very syncretistic. There was something about what was going on in Egypt that made it a place where maybe one would expect these documents. And so kind of a modern day analogy of this that I think can help put it in picture or help us get our heads around it a little bit. Imagine that there's this catastrophic event and everything in America is destroyed except for Salt Lake City. Everything is destroyed. It's all gone. The trees, the highways, our computers, our beloved iPads, everything is gone except for what's in Salt Lake City. And some future historian wants to know this culture that's been destroyed through some terrible thing. He wants to know what their religious life was like. So the only place that's left that could have anything is Salt Lake City, and he goes to Salt Lake City. And what he finds there is there's way more copies of the Book of Mormon in Salt Lake City than there are of the Quran, of the Torah, or of any other religious text. And what he says then is, well, all of America, the primary religious text that they used was the Book of Mormon. If someone said that, you would think he's totally, totally incompetent, because you would know from other outside sources, not just looking at whatever texts were left in Salt Lake City, that, well, the Bible, for one, was a very, very popular religious text in America, as well as, you would expect to find more copies of the Book of Mormon here, because that's the center of Mormonism. And so in the ancient world, you would expect to find more copies of these sorts of documents, these sort of gospels, in Egypt, because that's where we know culturally there was a breeding ground. And so what I've done is, during the same time, I put arrows that go all the way from modern-day France to where Jerusalem is, to just right up the road from the Nag Hammadi, where you have Christian church leaders who, I can list them all out, and there's quite a bit more, who say there's four Gospels, and who say these other Gospels are bogus. They're not They're not telling us the true story of Jesus. They're not telling any. They're not adding anything to the Christian faith. We reject them. I mean, maybe some of them are interesting to read. What's that?
What manuscript are they saying?
This is from, I have from 202 Common Era to 304. So this is all, yeah, so this is all during that same time. And so I think this then shows that what we do know of what was going on in the early church, this picture of the early church, it's really, really difficult to believe. That all throughout the Roman Empire, all throughout where the gospel was spreading, or where Christianity was spreading, these other gospels were legitimate and an acceptable source of, like, an acceptable scripture, I guess. But that's enough for that. We can talk more about kind of this picture of early Christianity. I want to actually get into looking at some of these gospels. And I want to do it by comparing them to the canonical Gospels. And so I'm just going to, from now on, because it gets a little confusing, Gnostic Gospels, non-canonical Gospels, all these things, I'm just going to call them the other Gospels. And then Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, I'm just going to refer to as the Gospels. That's about as unconfusing, I think, as I can be. But I want to look at three different areas to sort of compare and contrast them, to get our minds around, not even as much about the religious teaching, but just sort of get a feel for them. And I want to do two that are sort of like close-up, in-depth looks, so the relationship to history, looking at kind of small details, as well as the relationship to the Old Testament and the God of Israel. And then the third one is a bit kind of a big-picture thing. How Jesus is presented in this, his mission, his vocation, what he's on about, what's his purpose. So I want to compare the Gospels, these kind of issues in the Gospels with issues in these other Gospels. And starting with history, I want to look at a detail that's often overlooked, and it's names. It's the significance of names. And names are important when you're telling a story, because names give the story sort of a ring of credibility. If I was going to tell you a story about that I said was a true story, about a Civil War general, let's say he was a Confederate general, and his name was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, you'd probably be like, huh, that just doesn't sound right. That's an odd name for that culture, or for that space. Or if you were telling a story I don't know, 16th century China, an agrarian uprising in a small village, and it was led by a guy named Fred. Names don't make sense, but names are important because they lend a bit of credibility. And so an interesting thing that's happened, well, in some ways it's really boring, but then it becomes really interesting, that's happened in the last about 13 years is paying attention to the frequency in which people are named in the Gospels. And it sort of started with this woman. This is one of her books. Her name is Tal Alon. She's a feminist historian of antiquity. She's Jewish, and she teaches in Germany. And she wrote this book with this title that I'm sure is totally enticing to all of you. Lexicon of Jewish Names in Late Antiquity, Part 1. Palestine, 330 BCE to 200 Common Era. And there are sequels. There's three parts at this point. But what she's done in this book, and this is to me, I feel like this is like a scholar's scholar, that someone would want to ever do this. But what she's done is she's looked at all the available information, we have in Palestine from 330 BCE to 200 CE, so about a 500-year period. And what she's done is she's counted the regular or the names, how frequently names appear. So she's looked at burial records, she's looked at birth records, she's looked at marriage records, tax records, all of these things, and she's counted up in each. And what she's found, this is not even all of them. This is just a portion of it. It keeps going. I came across this in a very fascinating, very dense book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Baucom. He picks up on what she's doing and does some really I think he makes it quite interesting. But so what she does here is she sees names, most popular male names among Palestinian Jews, Jewish men, 330 in this time period. And she if you can see, I know some of these are small. Some of these are names that are familiar to us from the New Testament. We have Jesus. We have Simon. We have Levi. We have Herod. But then there's lots of names that are not as familiar to us, like Joachim or Thutis or Aristobulus, names that aren't familiar. And what she's done is she's basically just made a list of the most popular names during this time period. Of course, what interests us about this time period is right smack dab in the middle of this time period is when Jesus is purported to have lived in Palestine. And what she's found, well, she's done this, and then this guy, Richard Baucom, he's a New Testament, or he was a New Testament professor at St. Andrews. I think he's at Cambridge now. He's gone through, and he's seen that the relative popularity of these names. And so right down here, Simon or Joseph, this graph represents that. So the first two names that were there, Simon and Joseph, 1 and 2, 15% of men in Palestine during that time carried that name. And 41% of men carried one of these nine names. So Simon, Joseph, Lazarus, Judas, John, Jesus, Ananias, Jonathan, Matthew. So if you were in a room with 100 men, 41 and a half of them would be one of those names. So very common names. So this is, it's a very different, and then names that only appear once, only a little, it's 7.9%, about 8% of men had a name that would only appear once in all of these documents that she's sifted through. And it's interesting because this is, if any of you have had children or have friends that have children, there are these books that are published year after year, most common baby names. What she's done is sort of done that for this 500-year period in Palestine among Jews. But what Baucom has done is then he's gone through the Gospels and Acts, and he's done the same thing, the same study. What's the relative popularity of named male characters? And the overlap is unbelievable, where there is 15% of men in the ancient in Palestine, 15.6 are Simon and Joseph. It's 18.2 in the New Testament and in the Gospels. And then it's 40.3% of men have one of those nine names, as well as where it was 41% for the broader culture. And then this is a little different, 3.9%, about 4% have names that appear once, where it's 8%. And so there is this, the percentage for named men in the New Testament correlates in this really, really remarkable manner to the names of the population at the time. And it gives it this air of plausibility or believability. If you moved into the diaspora, Jews during that time, so that's Jews who were living outside of Jerusalem at that time. So the most popular names were names like Sabbatius, Dosius, Pappus, Ptolemaeus. Names we're not really familiar with, names that also aren't in the New Testament. And so again, this is really relatively new information. Her book was published in 2002. His book was in 2007. But what it does, it shows that the Gospels evidence really an uncanny and undeniable pattern for naming that was going on in the broader time and place. It shows, it's something that if you're writing historical fiction, you aim for this. So the Gospels have that, the names that are used have that air of believability about them, unlike having Fred leading a agrarian uprising in China. And then what's interesting is if you move into the non-canonical Gospels, things, people that are named, and I use the term non-derivative names, like I said before, all the non-canonical Gospels were written after the four Gospels. So they use lots of names of characters from the Gospels. But when they introduce new names, you get names like Sophia, Zenon, Barbalo, Nimrod, Yaldabaoth, Autogenes, Hamaliath, Galileo, and there's more. And none of these names make the list at all. None of these names, we don't know any people during that 500-year time period who were living in Israel or living in Palestine at the time who had those names. So this kind of doesn't necessarily prove the historical reliability of the Gospels, but it shows that the Gospels have a real deep awareness, and their patterns of naming make sense with the patterns of naming that were going on in the broader culture at the time. And so now I want to move to name places within the Gospels. This is also interesting about how the Gospels in the New Testament sort of touch down in actual geographical places. So there's, again, in the four Gospels, there's 23 towns and villages. Some are big cities that, you know, are big cultural centers at the time, like Jerusalem. Others are small, out-of-the-way places like Bethpage. But there's 23 places named. Each Gospel has 12 to 14 places named. But if you move into the non-canonical Gospels, where they touch down in history and in geography, you see it's just a totally different thing. So the Gospel of Mary, for example, does not name any place in the world. The Gospel of Thomas moves a little bit closer, and it names the world and Judea. The Gospel of Philip also names the world, but it names Jerusalem and Nazareth, but it thinks Nazareth is Jesus' middle name, so it sort of doesn't count as a place, but I could add it to the list of names on the previous slide. The Gospel of Peter mentions Jerusalem, but most of the other Gospels don't ever mention any historical or any geographical place. They don't take place, they don't happen in time or in space, they sort of glibly float above the particularities of the culture they claim to be speaking about. And this is one more instance of a named thing that, again, just shows unfamiliarity and gives an air of... it just shows that they're very difficult to take as accurate or real accounts of what Jesus was teaching. In the New Testament, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's a story where Jesus is presented with a coin, and he's trying to be trapped by the teachers of the law at the time, and they say to him, should we pay taxes? And Jesus says, give me a denarius. This is a denarius. The same story is told in the Gospel of Thomas. It's told again, but in the Gospel of Thomas, it's not a denarius, it's an aureus. And the difference between the two of them is, a denarius in that time was, if you were a laborer, it was a full day's wage. If you were a teacher, it was half a day's wage. Or an aureus, if you were a teacher, it was a month's wage. And if you were a laborer, it was a 2 months' wage. So to think that there's a story where, again, this doesn't necessarily prove anything, but it shows an unfamiliarity, I think, with the culture and the context, the time and place that it's claiming to. It really gives it an air of, it just shows its distance. Because who carries around a month's wages in their pocket? At a time. So it's just, it shows an odd difference, especially when recounting the same, or supposedly recounting the same teaching of Jesus. But as we'll see, as you move into the next thing, the relationship of the Old Testament, relationship of the Gospels to the Old Testament and to the God of Israel, even when they recount the same story, they do it in very, very different ways. So I put this quote up, this verse at the front, because anyone who picks up a New Testament and reads it can be clued into how the New Testament authors, or the Gospel authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are understanding their stories of Jesus as being part of a larger story of the people of Israel, of their God, of Yahweh, the covenant-making creator God of the world. And they do this really convenient thing. Like this happens right in the beginning of Mark, and I put it in red right there for you. It says, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet, and then it goes on to quote, it actually quotes Malachi, and then it quotes Isaiah. It says, I will send my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare the way, a voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight his path. But they clue you in on that they're quoting the Old Testament. And it's hard to miss. And what they do is they're placing Jesus within, again, the broader story of the people of Israel, and they're saying that the story of Israel is coming to a climax, right? It's coming to its purpose, its fulfillment in the life, teaching, ultimately death and resurrection of Jesus. But they also do this in really subtle ways. And scholars talk about allusions or echoes or intertextual references, where the New Testament authors, if you have a familiarity with the Old Testament, they'll quote or allude to or make reference to the Old Testament, but they're not going to tell you that. And so this is a story from the Gospel of Mark, and I've done the same thing, where it's an old, but I've added the where the Old Testament reference is coming from, because that's not in the text. Mark isn't saying, as it says in Isaiah, as it says in Genesis. But I'm going to read the story. And it says, "And then he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower," which is filled with allusions to a story early on in Isaiah. "Then he leased it to tenants and went to another country. When the season came, he sent a slave to the tenants to collect from them his share of the produce of the vineyard. But they seized him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And again, he sent another slave to them. This one they beat over the head and insulted. Then he sent another, and that one they killed. And so it was with many others. Some they beat, and others they killed. He still had one other, a beloved son," which is a term that's used in Genesis 22 of Joseph. And then it's used in Psalm 22 to speak about the king, and Isaiah 42 to talk about the Messiah, this beloved son. It's a specific term. And it's finally, he sent them to them saying, "They will respect my son." But those tenants said to one another, "This heir, come, let us kill him." This is a quote that's it's the same phrase, the exact same phrase that's used in the story of Joseph when Joseph's brothers get together and say, "Come, let us kill him." It's verbatim. And if you know the story, you hear the echo. Whether or not Mark has told you, it's there, you hear it. And so it goes on. It says, "And the inheritance will be ours." So they seized him and they threw him out of the vineyard. "What then will the owner of the vineyard do? Will he come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others? Have you not read this in the scripture?" There you go, that's the direct part right there. "The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it was amazing in our eyes," which is from the Psalms. "Then when they realized that he had told this parable against them, they wanted to arrest him, but they feared the crowd. So they left him, and they went away." And so what the parable does is it places the life of Jesus, the story of Jesus, within the unfolding story of Israel. And it presents his death as sort of a climax of a pattern that's told of Israel, that the people who are familiar with the Old Testament would be familiar with, a pattern of unfaithfulness and judgment. But then it's interesting when the same story is recounted in the Gospel of Thomas. Again, you can see all of the Old Testament allusions have vanished, and it's not just because I conveniently removed the red font. When you read the Gospel of Thomas, who's ever written the Gospel of Thomas takes all of those things out, takes all of those echoes out, all of those allusions out, takes out the direct reference to Scripture. And so a scholar on the Gospel of Thomas who teaches at the School of Religion at Duke University talks about how Thomas systematically excludes all the resonant Old Testament allusions that appear in the canonical telling of the tale. The real effect of removing all of the Old Testament allusions, echoes, and resonances is that, and this is playing off our earlier point, it extracts the parable from its Jewish historical setting, and it distances itself from the cultural and religious context in which Jesus lived and taught. And what in Thomas is de-Judaized, if that's a word, version of this parable. It's just anemic, it's colorless, and the point is very different. Because Jesus in this story, in Mark's telling of it, Jesus is putting himself in this larger story of Israel's unfaithfulness, of Israel's continually missing on what God is doing. And he's saying it's going to climax with me. They're not going to get it. You don't have that in the Gospel of Thomas. And you might think, well, you pick up on this if you're kind of scholarly and you do a really close reading. But Thomas is very considerate of those who don't have time to do this sort of close reading. And he lets this sort of anti-Old Testament, anti-Jewish bias be known more explicitly. in an earlier quote, he says this: his disciples said to him, this is they're speaking to Jesus, 24 prophets spoke in Israel, and they all spoke about you. And Jesus, that he is Jesus, said to them, you have admitted the one living in your presence and spoken only of the dead. And it's in the context of the Gospel of Thomas, it's not as though he's just saying they've ceased breathing and they've died. In the Gospel of Thomas, what he's saying there is they're dead. They have no light. They have no life. They have no truth. There's nothing there for you. And if we move into something like the Gospel of Judas, which again, I said before, Judas is the hero of the story. He gets special revelation from Jesus. The Gospel of Judas is also very, very anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, in lots of ways, but one of the most explicit ways is Judas is the recipient of this special knowledge from Jesus, this secret knowledge from Jesus. And part of it has to do with the structure of the cosmos, these celestial hierarchies. There's 365 luminaries that the Gospel of Judas explains, and there's these clouds that give birth to spirits, and it's very, very confusing. But at the bottom of all of these deities is a god named Sackloss, and Sackloss is the god who made the world. Sackloss is the god who claims to be the only god, who claims to be the god of Israel who made the world. But Sackloss is an Aramaic word that means fool or idiot. So what the Gospel of Judas is saying is that you might think that the one God who made the world is a good and wise God, but really he's an idiot. It's very, very straightforward. It's interesting too, this gospel in particular is thought to be written by a group of Gnostics called the Sethians. And if you're familiar with the early chapters of Genesis, there's Adam, there's Eve, they have two kids, Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. Everything's a mess. They have a third kid, Seth. And this group, this very Gnostic group, believed that Seth was actually the offspring of Eve and God, and that Seth was bringing sort of new humanity. And the way they kind of followed, that Seth was sort of their spiritual lineage. And so, but what they were known for was if the God of Israel, through his law, said, don't eat pork, be monogamous, or obey the Sabbath. If God said that, if Yahweh said that, they were going to do the exact opposite. So they were going to eat lots of pork, they were going to sleep around, and they were going to party on the weekends. And so it's this group was sort of like bacon, sex, and rock and roll. And you could see how a group like that, they're very flagrant in their anti-Jewish disposition. And there's more that you can say, but when you read the Gospels, as opposed to the Gnostic, these non-canonical Gospels, you have things like this in Jesus' mouth. Jesus says, if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. Jesus is again saying, the Old Testament is all about me. It's not worthless. There's stuff in there that's true, and it's about me. And at the end of the Gospel of Luke, the disciples meet Jesus on the road to Emmaus, and he opens their eyes about how all the scriptures are talking about him. So Jesus has a much, much higher view of Judaism and the Old Testament scriptures than these other gospels do. And then, so those kind of, I want to then look at Jesus' mission, his purpose, his vocation. What is Jesus on about? This is when we sort of get into some of the teaching or some of the substance of these Gospels. So the Gospel of Thomas starts like this. It says, these are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke, and which Didymus, Judas, Thomas wrote down. And Didymus, Judas, Thomas literally means twin brother, twin. And what these secrets are about all throughout is about Jesus' real identity, who Jesus really is and who we are. And so this is one example of what it's like. Like I said, the Gospel of Thomas is all of these sayings. Even scholars or people who love the Gospel of Thomas haven't been able to really decipher an order or a pattern to the Gospel of Thomas. It's just like saying after saying after saying, just sort of randomly connected. But this is one of them. It says, Jesus said to his disciples, make a comparison and tell me, who am I like? Simon Peter said to him, you're like a righteous angel. Matthew said to him, you are like a wise philosopher. Thomas said to him, teacher, my mouth cannot let me say at all what you are like. Jesus said, I am not your teacher, for you have drunk and become intoxicated from the bubbling spring that I myself have measured out. And he took him, they withdrew, and he said three sayings to him. Now when Thomas came to his companions, they asked him, what did Jesus say to you? Thomas said to them, if I tell you one of the sayings he said to me, you will take up stones and cast them at me, and fire will come out of the stones and burn you. And so it's really bizarre, but at the heart of it, I mean, it feels bizarre to us, but I'm not trying to read just to make fun of it, but it's very, very esoteric, right? It's not something you can get your hands around. Jesus is giving secrets to particular disciples. Later on in the Gospel of Thomas, it says, blessed are the solitary ones and the elect, for you will find the kingdom, for you have come from it, and you will return there. And so what he's going after is knowing this knowledge about Jesus that Thomas isn't able to share. Thomas can't tell you these three things that Jesus told him, evidently. But it has something to do with the soul leaving the body, leaving this world, and going to the kingdom. And so it's very anti, again, the Gospel of Thomas, is all, and all of them are very anti-body. They don't like your body. Your body is what's ruining your relationship. Actually, even relationship is the wrong word. It's too personal. Your connection with God. And it talks about, in the Gospel of Thomas, that Jesus was being carried around in a body. But your body is a specific problem for you in the Gospel of Thomas if you're a woman. The very last saying of the Gospel of Thomas, I don't have it written down here, is a bit of a wild card, and it says this. It says, Simon Peter said to them, Mary should leave us, for females are not worthy of this life. Jesus said, look, I am going to guide her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every female who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven. So it's, but it's very bizarre. It's in the sense, it's esoteric in the sense of, it's just like, what are they, what's being said? And that same sort of antibody teaching shows up in the Gospel of Mary. And again, the Gospel of Mary, we don't have the whole Gospel, we just have fragments. Mary has a vision, and she knows in the Gospel, and she's sharing them with the other disciples. The disciples are really, really upset because they know they're going to die, just like Jesus died. And then this is a quote. This is from 18 and 19. It says, the disciples were upset. The same fate awaits them as the Savior. Interestingly enough, the Gospel of Mary never mentions Jesus. It only speaks about the Savior. For being about Jesus, it never even says his name. But then Mary stood up, greeted them all, and said to her brethren, do not weep and do not grieve, nor be irresolute. For his grace will be entirely with you and will protect you. But rather, let us praise his greatness, for he has prepared us and made us into men. And it's that same idea of being transformed, for a woman to be transformed into a man. But the Gospel of Mary is also, like I said before, it's very anti-body, and the goal of what salvation is you escape the body. And the Gospel of Mary, if anyone has ever had to cross a border from one country into another, and you've been told in advance by someone who's already done it, have all your paperwork in order, make sure you say the right things, don't say too much, don't say too little, you don't want to be suspicious. The Gospel of Mary is really Mary giving advice on crossing the border into the afterlife, because you're going to encounter evil spirits, and those evil spirits are going to question you, and if you don't have the right things to say to the evil spirits, they're not going to let you pass. Which, if anyone's familiar that are familiar with Egyptian folk religion, that's the sort of thing you read in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And so there's two of them. One's Desire. One's called. There's a third. We don't have the full text, so we don't know what it's called. But there's there's these demons. These spirits are called Desire and Ignorance. And then the Gospel of Judas again is interested in giving secret knowledge of Jesus' true identity. And Judas is the one who knows this. Judas is the one who hears it. Judas rightfully claims to know who Jesus is, who he is, and where he came from, which is the immortal realm of Barbalo. And Barbalo was a well-known figure at the time within sort of Gnostic big cosmological systems, heavenly realms. In the Gospel of Judas, like in the Gospel of Mary, like in the Gospel of Thomas, like in a lot of these other ones, Jesus isn't really embodied, so there's no way for him to lay his life down for his friends, but he's able to tell you about, again, the nature of the universe, 365 illuminaries, and all those sorts of things. And the Gospel of Thomas is more so than any of, or sorry, the Gospel of Judas, more so than any of the other Gnostic Gospels, is really an attack on the church, the early church. The first thing that happens in the Gospel of Thomas is Jesus comes across his disciples, and they're celebrating and giving thanks. And giving thanks in Greek is the word Eucharist, Eucharisto. And so they're celebrating the Eucharist, and what Jesus does is he laughs at them. And he tells them they're idiots, and that they really, they're worshiping their God, but they don't really know the truth. So Jesus in the Gospel of Judas shows up, and he makes fun of the church. And later on, there's a vision where the other disciples are accused of murder and rape and theft. And this is all stuff that Jesus, who again is from the immortal eon or realm of Barbalo, really believes. Then even in this Gospel of Philip that we talked about briefly, the Gospel of Philip, again, we just have a very short and very fragmentary text of it, talks about escaping, the soul escaping the body through two baptisms, a water baptism and a chrism baptism. And the Gospel of Philip is also really explicit. In the Gospel of Philip, the world came about through a mistake. Again, just like in the Gospel of Judas, where the creator God of Israel is called Sophlos, he's an idiot, he's a buffoon. It's the same thing you have in the Gospel of Philip. You don't have that same name, but it's really, it's an attack on the God who made things that are physical, and the soul needs to escape the physical realm and get back to it. So in a lot of these Gospels, you could talk about creation as fall. The world is really the problem. And I can't sort of totally resist this, but the Gospel of Philip is one of the key texts for those various theories about Jesus and Mary Magdalene kind of getting together and, getting married and having kids and running away. And so the Gospel of Philip is really the first text that started all of that. And then I'm going to read you from that text where this sort of theory comes from, where this idea comes from. This is a translation from Simon Gathercole, who's a scholar at Cambridge, and it goes like this. And blank also means there's a hole in the text. It's not me cursing, like or editing the cursing. But this is the text that evidently teaches that Jesus had a wife that was Mary, and they kind of got together. So, and blank companion of the blank, Mary Magdalene, blank, used to blank more than the other's disciples, blank. Greet or kiss her, blank times, the rest, blank, blank. So just throwing that out there, it's really difficult to go from there to Jesus running away with Mary and having kids and having a great life and white picket fence and the first white picket fence probably. But what you see in all these Gospels, these non-canonical Gospels, these other Gospels, Jesus comes primarily to give secret knowledge. And they're all very different. It's hard to sort of just lump them into one thing. But the knowledge usually revolves around the nature of the cosmos, especially celestial hierarchies. It tells a lot about how the God who made this world is actually a buffoon, and that our, the goal of the soul is to get out of this world, to get out of this body. And there's some, there's really a dizzying amount of detail in some of these. But what's interesting is in none of these two, there's no talk of love. Jesus isn't someone who loves anything. Jesus is someone who comes, who floats above the particularity of history, of culture, of people's lives, and sort of just drops these very esoteric, very difficult things to sort of make sense of that are secret knowledge. And a lot of this, too, it's very, very elitist in the sense of if you don't get it, you're not elect, you're not ever going to get it. There's kind of nothing you can do about it. Like in the Gospel of Thomas, it said, blessed are the solitary and the elect. And a lot of these, if you don't, if you're not on the inside, you're definitely on the outside. And so then when we move to the Gospels, Jesus' purpose, Jesus' mission, a lot could be said. Many lectures could be said on this. But I wanted to just sort of frame what Jesus is about through statements of why the Son of Man came or why the true light came. So this idea of, I think that word came gives like purpose, vocation, mission. And so in Mark and Matthew it says, for the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So there's a debt that's been accrued, right? There's something that needs to be paid off, and what Jesus does is he pays it with his life. He gives his life for God so loved that he gave. And it's interesting even looking at the amount of space in the Gospels that's devoted to Jesus' last week. The Gospel of John, half of the Gospel of John is Jesus in his final week leading to the cross. And it's the same for Mark. It's a little bit less than Luke. Some people call the Gospels passion narratives, which is the last week of Jesus' life, with extended introductions. But they're mostly about that. And then the second thing is the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. That people were lost, that something was wrong, that people needed to be found. And then and the fourth one, so these two are almost like the what, and I think this is the how. The Son of Man came eating and drinking. And they say, here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So Jesus came and didn't just sort of drop esoteric truth bombs on the spiritually elite. He came and he spent time with the lowly, with the outcast, with tax collectors, with sinners, with people who were damned. He spent time with them and he spoke with them publicly. Jesus' ministry in the Gospels is almost entirely public ministry. He's talking to people. And then in the Gospel of John, John brings it all together very poetically. This is from the first chapter of John. The true light gives light to everyone who's coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believe in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. And the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Then skipping a few verses, no one has ever seen God but the one and only Son, who is himself God, and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. So Jesus has come to give us light. Jesus has come to make us children, to invite us into his family. And Jesus has come, Jesus is the one who has seen the Father and knows the Father, and Jesus has come to make him known. So Jesus in the Gospels, when we see Jesus, we see the Father, right? We see who God actually is. Jesus himself said, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. And so, in closing, I just want to say, to summarize, that these Gospels, the Gospels we have, present a picture of a believable Jesus in the time and space that they claim to narrate, who's reliable. And there's other ways you can study sort of the historicity of Jesus besides looking at names. There's a couple books here. Jesus is attested in sources outside of the New Testament, historical sources. but he's trustworthy. And he's also part of a bigger story, a story where the world is good, where something went wrong, and God is on a mission to get it right, to fix it. And the story is climaxing in Jesus' life and his teaching. And then Jesus does so through being with people, through giving his life as a ransom for many, for seeking and saving what was lost, for bringing light, and for showing us the Father. And in closing, I wanted to share a story from this theologian named T.S. Torrance, who's a Scottish theologian, and he passed away a few years ago. I think he taught at St. Andrews, or maybe Aberdeen. But he was a chaplain in World War II. And he saw a lot of people die. And he retells a story about he was in his early 30s, and he was on the battlefield, and he came across a young man who had been shot and who was dying. This guy was barely 20 years old, probably. And the guy looked at Torrance, and he said to him, "Padre, Father, is God like Jesus?" That was the question he asked. If we trust the Gospels we have, the answer is yes, God is like Jesus. If we have these other Gospels thrown in there, it becomes very muddled. Very, very confusing. And so that's where I want to end and open it up to questions. There's so much more to say. There's lots of questions I still have. I'm still learning about all these things. If you need to go, you're free to go. I don't know what time it is. But we open it up for questions here, and we'll stay for as long as anyone wants to talk. But if before you... and if, again, feel free to leave if you need to. But... if you would just say your name, if I don't know who you are, if you have a question, if you would say your name, just so I would know your name. But yeah, we can talk about all this stuff for a little while.
I'm trying to shut that off. My eyes.
Oh, can I do that? Is that a little softer? I like having something up there. I'm just being honest. Yeah, this is awesome. I mean, why don't we look at this picture? Yeah. This is great. This is actually a picture of our summer vacation. This is where Sarah and I went. Fantastic. We have a great time. Great time in Galia. Yeah. Yes.
So I was thinking about your comment about the road to Emmaus and how Jesus is kind of rooted in Israel and in biblical history.
Yeah.
And I think that actually it's much more intense and extreme than that, because the disciples were saying to Jesus, "Don't you know what happened? The one that we thought was the Messiah has just been killed. And now, basically, now we know he wasn't." And Jesus' response was to rebuke them. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't say, why are you so slow to believe all the miracles that I did? Why are you so slow to believe the things that I told you? Or why are you so slow to believe I told you 3 days before that in 3 days I'd rise from the dead? No, he says, why are you so slow to believe all the prophets have said about him? So he's turning to the prophets as his source of authenticity and legitimacy.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's way beyond just rooted there. And so it's kind of a lock and a key. The lock validates the key, and the key validates the lock. Because they foretold him, and he fulfills them, he's validating that.
Yeah.
Only a divine author and source could have initiated any of it.
Yeah, I mean, that was like the quote from John where Jesus said, if you believed Moses, you'd believe me, because Moses was talking about me. Like, this was about me. So, yeah, I think you're right. Like, it's, it is very much Jesus is making some very strong claims about what the Old Testament was about. Yeah, Marty?
My understanding, I've just read a little bit of this stuff, not that much, but it's Bart Ehrman and some of these folks are claiming that these Gnostic Gospels were older than the four Gospels were original? How on earth did they come up with that?
Bart Ehrman, from what I've read about Bart Ehrman, Bart Ehrman does not say that. Oh, Bart Ehrman would say Bart Ehrman says Mark was written in 63. So he gives the Gospels early dates, and he does not. Like, Elaine Pagels is very vocal, or at least she's well-published.
Right.
And so she gets a voice. And she would say that John is, like, 120, but that Thomas is before John. And that Thomas, John was written specifically crafted to shut down the Christianity in the Gospel of Thomas. That John is really a polemic against Thomas, and that Thomas comes before Thomas. I think she would put Thomas at, like, I forget. But before, or probably like between 100 and 110, something like that. So she would place Thomas before John. But a lot of, it seems like, at least some of those, it seems some of the bigger names are fine to say, yeah, they came later. But they're still, it's still that story of when they came, they were accepted. They were all on equal footing. So it's not necessarily who was the earliest in their sort of in their discussion or the way they frame it. Early doesn't necessarily mean better. It's just they were all accepted until later on. And you know, in some ways, they make it really hard to falsify their theory because they say, well, they just destroyed all the copies we didn't have. But I think it's still very difficult. I think it's like I use the word conspiracy. I feel like it's a bit of a conspiracy. We have these texts and we're just gonna make up some story. Well, it's not we're gonna make up, but they have a very deliberate agenda to sort of discredit Orthodox Christianity by saying that it's really an invention of later sort of political moves. But at least from what I read to come across it, or what I read, scholars that are working at reputable institutions, University of Toronto, University of Chicago, Duke, Cambridge, it's not an argument of who was first. I think it's by and large accepted from what I've read that the canonical, especially Matthew, I mean Mark, you know, Mark, Matthew, and Luke were first. But I think Pagel stands alone. I don't think. I mean, again, she's just really well publicized, which then makes it. I mean, she's like she's bestsellers, and so it's almost like what happens in these esteemed academic journals. It almost doesn't matter because like dozens and dozens of people are reading these journals, you know, only. There are other academics. So in some ways, like, even though I think she would be an odd person out, she still has a lot, her theory still has a lot of power, I guess, or carries a lot of weight. Yeah. Was that, you asked just about dates, was that what you started?
Yeah, go ahead. Other people have
anything. Yeah, Rachel?
Can you distinguish me the extra books that are in the Catholic Bible with
the Apocrypha?
Yeah.
So those are books that are that would be, and someone can correct me here, but those predate the writing of the New Testament, so they're Jewish. They're stories of that would happen in between kind of the 400 years between Malachi, the end of kind of Old Testament history and the beginning of the New Testament. So they tell the story of Jewish revolt, like the Maccabees, and other things like that. And so, they're part of the reason why, especially the Protestant reformers. I don't know all this stuff super well, but I mean, they're books that are never quoted in the Old New Testament, or are never really referenced, I believe. And so, the reformers put them on sort of dubious ground, I think. Or felt they were on dubious ground. If anyone wants to answer that before we move.
They're not in the Hebrew scriptures either.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, very important.
Yeah, 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 good point.
But Jesus quotes from every Old Testament book except Esther, I think, and not one of the apocryphal books he quotes from.
Right. Or maybe it, Jesus and Paul combined.
Maybe.
Yeah. any other answers? Is that it?
So you're saying that he quotes from Edward?
Jesus. And
the New Testament authors. The New Testament authors quote the Old Testament.
All the Old Testament.
Every Old Testament book. Okay. Except one.
Okay.
It's Esther.
Yeah. Tom, did you have a question?
Yeah. Early on in your presentation, you don't have to put it up. I believe there was a table that showed some of the sources of some of these.
Yeah, sure. I can go back to
that. And I thought I saw Irenaeus and Origen.
Yes.
And church fathers.
Yes.
Yet you also said that some of the church fathers said, don't pay attention to this nonsense.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to square those two.
Yeah. So that's how we know about some of these.
They referred to them.
They referred to them.
It's a source. It
yeah,
not,
yeah, yeah.
It's not
so the source is...
reference.
Yeah, it's just people named it. So, like, we knew there was the Gospel of Judas long before
it was.
No, they didn't write it, but they were like, look out for this. So that's what I meant by sources. I mean, and some of these, so there's a whole other category of Gospels, sort of other Gospels that are called, like, Jewish Christian Gospels, the Gospel of the Hebrews, the Gospel of the Ebionites, and all of those, we only have quotations from church fathers who quote it. Sometimes it's like a bit of a cultural faux pas now, but sometimes the church fathers would, like especially Irenaeus, he would give long extended quotations of sort of these other teachings, especially sort of, there's a group, the Valentinians, Gnostic Valentinians, that wrote this Gospel of Truth. And so Irenaeus will just quote it. He's like, look, this is what they teach. And his idea is sort of like, you're going to think it's so ridiculous, you're not going to want to believe it. You're going to think it's the stupidest thing you ever heard. And so, like, that's what we know of the Gospel of Truth, really. Like, that's, I mean, there's some of it from the Nag Hammadi, but it's not a full thing. So that's what I meant by quoting the sources.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. A modern sort of parallel to, like, what they were doing there is, I was just telling Sarah this the other night, South Park, the TV show, had an episode where they basically told the secret teachings of Scientology, and which is all about how the world came to be and these spirits came into the volcano. I don't understand it. But anyway, their approach was, all they did was present it. They illustrated it and presented it. And it made people laugh just to watch it. Like, they didn't have to do anything else. And so sometimes, again, that's not like faux pas, or that's kind of a cultural faux pas in our postmodern kind of what's true for you spiritually is good for you kind of moment. But that's sort of what the church fathers would often do with some of these Gospels. They just sort of present them and say, kind of choose for yourself. Yes, Thomas?
In the book of Jude, he does refer to other, to one or two other writings from all time, from the Old Testament.
He refers to the book of Enoch.
Yeah, I mean, Paul quotes other philosophers, you know, in Acts. Like, it's not as though just the quotation of something it doesn't necessarily mean that it's legitimating it as scripture. It's just I think it's just a quotation, but.
Or that there's a valid thread in Jude that's worth quoting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Beth.
You said that the proponents of these other Gospels are attempting to discredit. I guess my question is, are they attempting to discredit the four, what we would say, the real Gospels, or are they discrediting the whole of Scripture, and how would they do that? How would they reconcile the differences in their Gospel with the rest of Scripture?
I think what they're trying to do is, different scholars have sort of different agendas, or different writers, spiritual writers have different agendas. So some of them, all they want to do is say, through presenting this sort of picture of the early church, say, like, look, the Gospel of Mary is a valid Christian spiritual text.
Wasn't your question, what was the original author of the
book? Are we talking about original authors?
Or? No. What they're saying is, are they saying
different things?
Part of the Bible, or
some are saying it should be part of the Bible, like, or some are saying it should be part of just sort of legitimate Christian spiritual writing. Whether or not they want to say it's canonical, I mean, talk about like a power play, you know, like how could you enforce the Gospel of Thomas on, you know, however many millions and billions of Christians there are. And some of them, like Bart Ehrman, just, I think he primarily wants to discredit Christianity, like or like contemporary Christianity, and or the church. I guess he wants to discredit Orthodox Christianity. And it's interesting, like he grew up and went to like Moody Bible Institute, Wheaton College. He went to Princeton.
Was he the guy that wrote Misquoting Jesus?
He wrote Misquoting Jesus. And I think he, yeah, I think he is kind of a bit of an axe to grind.
And essentially, whatever gospels he wanted.
His argument essentially is all of these gospels that we have were all legitimate, and this one group that's now what we see Christianity, now what we understand Orthodox Christianity, they were just a bunch of bullies. They were intolerant, and they, you know, they destroyed copies of these other texts. They did all of these awful things in the name of their four gospels. I mean, what his proof at most of it is, he talks about kind of the rhetoric of the church fathers, when it's not just sometimes they quote, sometimes they like they go on the attack. So when the Gospel of Judas says the apostles were murderers, they were rapists, church fathers will come back and be like, no, like, that's not true. So they're sort of, they sling mud back and forth at one another. I think that's pretty much the extent of what we, it's pretty much the extent of his argument. And then just the fact, too, that we don't have these. We know they exist because, you know, this early church historian wrote about them, or this early church father spoke about them. But we don't have them anymore, so now we've cut them out.
I think, I'd love you to comment a little bit more on this, but a lot of the argument is that these dead white males, who, at some council in not until the 3rd or 4th century, officially recognized the canon, that these were the canon. But what they ignore is that, in fact, those books were unofficially recognized pretty universally by the churches as being authoritative and being canonical long before before a council got together and you know declared them to be. And that was done because they were coming under fire. And in the sense that we have to preserve this canon. These are the books that the Holy Spirit inspired the writers to write. And wasn't there I remember reading F.F. Bruce's little book, The New Testament Documents and Reliable, a long time ago, but reference to a very early list in Rome, a really early list of the books that were recognized, Paul's letters and the Gospels, four Gospels, recognized sort of rubber stamp. Long before that council.
Yeah, you might be the Muratorian fragment, is that what he's talking about? But kind of the earliest would be, that we have would be Irenaeus, who was up here in France, Irenaeus of Lyon, so he's like 170, 180. But we have, within 20 years, I didn't read out all of these different guys' names, but these are all over the empire. We have people just, it's not as though they're, and often it's, they're saying it when they're talking about something else. But they're just saying, the four Gospels are the four. There are four Gospels, and it's just sort of like something that they sort of slip in. And part of the church, part of what I feel like makes that story difficult. Makes it difficult to believe is, you know, the church was in a lot of ways on the run. And there was no bureaucratic structures of power. There was no seat of authority. Local bishops, which are just church leaders, I think struggled in their own sort of geographical region And so it's absurd to think that a bishop up here could have any say about what's going on in the churches throughout the rest of the empire. But what we see is all those other churches, quite a few of those other churches are sort of on the same page. They're sort of acknowledging there are these four, there are four gospels. There's no more and there's no less. And there's a scene in the Da Vinci Code movie where at the, Council of Nicaea, they're sort of arguing about the books of the Bible. I mean, that's Dan Brown. That's not Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman wrote a book saying the Da Vinci Code is nonsense. Like, it's historically, it's nonsense. And they are men, but they're not white men. They are dead, and they are men. Bart Ehrman's doctoral advisor at Princeton is this guy, Bruce Metzger, who Ehrman says is the best textual critic.
Yeah,
he's my scholar's, my dream. And what Metzger says is totally different than what Bart Ehrman says. Bart Ehrman makes a lot of money off of publishing. But he says neither individuals nor councils created the canon. Instead, they came, and this is at the end of quite a large book. This is a quotation from a smaller book. Neither individuals nor councils created the canon. Instead, they came to recognize and acknowledge the self-authenticating quality of these writings, which impose themselves as canonical upon the church. So, and part of why I think it's difficult for people to hear that is because what that's doing is it's kicking down the boundaries of what history can tell us, because it's talking about a supernatural thing. There's something about these texts. They have a power that we can't sort of quantify and verify and put in a historically explicable narrative. But what a lot of people who, I think, give it a fair look say, these stories have power, and they, like Metzger said, they're self-authenticating. They're self...
What do you mean by kicking down history? I didn't...
Well, there's parameters about like what history can and can't tell us, right? According to modern conceptions of history, and it's usually some things that are verifiable, sort of scientific. And so to say that a text asserted itself on a group of people because it has supernatural power, you can't prove that historically. Like, you can make any number of other... I mean, I still believe it, but you can make any other... ways of explaining why it did what it did. It empowered women. It empowered slaves. So that's what I was saying.
Okay. I could add to that comment. Are you familiar with a book probably written in the 60s by a fellow named Houston or Huston Smith called The Religions of Man? I don't know what his beliefs are, but the book is interesting because he compares the major religions not based upon what the theoreticians of each religion say, but based upon what the average person gets out of it, the average lay person in each religion. And he makes a striking statement. He says, of all the religions on the planet, the major ones, not the minor ones, that Judaism and, by extension, Christianity are the only ones that are almost the only ones that say that the physical comes out of the spiritual. Most of them say you are spiritual in spite of the physical, which is exactly the message that the Gnostics have. This spiritual is bad, and as you say, that arises from Egypt, which
it was there.
It was there. It's just a sixth grade understanding. Egypt has lots of gods and has had for millennia, and the idea, this idea that your physical body gets in the way of being spiritual, as opposed to the Jews were very clear about, and God said the creation was good.
Yeah.
Right.
I'll parenthetically say I'm a little sad that modern Christianity seems to veer away from that.
Yeah.
The only exception that Huston Smith gave to that, he said that Taoism in China says that the physical being is good, except that they put man not at the top of it all, but just in the middle somewhere.
Yeah. Does anyone else have anything? Who hasn't asked a question so far? Yes, ma'am? Or?
I just want to say that one of the most convincing things for me of the difference between the two Gospels is when, I think it was the Book of Thomas, and they said to Peter, "Who do you say Jesus is?" And in the Thomas book, they said, "He's a righteous angel." Mm-hmm. And in the Bible, "He's the Son of God." Mm-hmm. What a difference that is.
Yeah. Tim, right?
Tim.
Yeah, Tim.
That's good. I was just going to say that, I've actually had a fair deal of experience studying the Egyptian mystery cult as
yeah.
were important to the Roman Empire, and this whole idea of essentially having this hidden knowledge that is available to a select few,
yeah.
and that the majority of initiates are unaware of, and that if you're not going to get it, then you're just not going to get it. That was a major feature of the Isis and Osiris cult as they were part of the Empire. And I feel that sort of this whole creation of Christianity in Egypt, it's really, in many ways, people probably coming from that type of cultic background attempting to then reinterpret Christianity into their own already sort of bastardized ideas of the older Egyptian religion, which actually did have a higher emphasis on the value of the physical. I mean, the ideas of, you know, the physical world being evil, essentially, and the spiritual world being preferable and superior in the physical system. A lot of that, I feel like, comes from the Pythagoreans and a lot of the Hellenic cults that then all kind of fused and worked in foment in Egypt. And I feel like these texts are probably exemplary of the final period of that, where these people were already syncretic, but now important Christianity is yet another secret.
Yeah.
This really...
That's really interesting. What got you into studying...
Well, you know,
okay. Oh, you're one of those, huh? Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You guys did classics together.
Yeah,
okay. That's great. It's great to see people who did classics, doing stuff.
Part of the reason why the Gospel of Thomas and some of these other men have such negative views of women have to become like men to be saved, is because their view of childbearing is the Gnostic view of childbearing is that when a woman gets pregnant, her body encapsulates spirit and drags it down. Mm-hmm. And there's some very interesting Christian classic scholar who's done some very interesting work on the 1 Timothy 2 passage, which refers to women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness. And that's part of a passage that's got huge problems with it. But this classic scholar has suggested that it's clear in 1 and 2 Timothy there are a lot of early Gnostic ideas floating around in there. Views of different gods and against the body, against foods, against marriage, and so on. And that her suggestion is that that's actually a correction of this false view of childbearing, of women in childbearing. So in other words, the emphasis is women will be saved through childbearing rather than lose their salvation if they bear children, as long as they continue in faith, love, and holiness, which are faith is what saves anybody, men, women, mothers or not. But it's a really interesting. It's one of the most plausible explanations of a very difficult passage, because when you try to make sense of that passage any other way, when it's a correction. Women will be saved through childbearing. Mm-hmm. They don't lose their salvation. They don't have to become like men in order to be saved or give up childbearing.
Yeah.
Catherine Prager, she wrote a book called A Second Coming of Christ, which is on it's on that Timothy passage.
That it's important to keep in mind that God is not the author of confusion, and any writing I think that creates confusion, is one sign that's not of God. But that actually seemed a lot easier to determine whether those writings that you showed us were of God or not than I expected. It's really obvious stuff. But the other thing that I wanted to say is I was talking with our pastor Sunday because he was doing a lot of symbolism in the sacrifice where Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac. That whole thing, that whole story, there's so much symbolism of Christ and what God did through Christ, that it's incredible. And he had to like preach more than one sermon on it, maybe more than two. But and I was talking to him afterwards, and I started wondering why, and I think I answered my own question, but why would God want to have all these things in the Old Testament that point to Christ? Okay, and I was, what I think, what I came up with is, he could have just had Christ come and die on the cross, right? But, and then we would all have to figure out who this guy was that showed up, you know what I'm saying? But there's so much, it was, you know, it was so important for mankind to understand once Jesus came, and to be able to look back on all that God was trying to show us through the whole Old Testament times, you know, so that we would really be able to see God's hand from way back, you know, and help to authenticate Christ. But do you understand what I'm saying? I think it's why, one reason why it's so important that any of the Gospels are tied in appropriate ways with what is in the Old Testament, to point out the, you know, the important things that show, and also, you know, Christ's authenticity, and to show how that they should show how that he fulfilled all that stuff too.
Does anyone else have any questions or comments? Oh, I'm going to go over with Ben real quick.
Just a comment that I found just very helpful about this lecture was the I guess the sort of buzzword, and I haven't read a lot of this more contemporary scholarship, but the buzzword you hear is multiple Christianities.
Yeah.
So there was a time in the early church where there were multiple Christianities, which, as you pointed out, helpfully, it's just a lot like modern America, where everybody just says that it's okay to believe what you believe, and how implausible it is that that would be the climate back then. Just reading the sampling of things that you gave us tonight, as compared to passages in the canonical gospels, it's not even the same. It's not even the same religion. It's not even close to the same.
Yeah, it's a different world, I think.
View of God, view of creation, view of what's the matter. View, I mean, it's all the key points that we talk about being what determines the worldview. It's not even on the same planet.
Yeah.
So to refer to multiple Christianities.
Right, in terms of immortal Aeon of Barbalo.
Yeah, maybe other religions, but to lump them into one category and say multiple Christianities to lose all sense of the meaning of the word.
And
it's so diverse, it's not even.
And it's, you know, even. I mean, even bringing up the Apocrypha and that Roman Catholics accept that book, like the strand of Christianity that accepted the four Gospels that has become, you know, Orthodox, it's hard also not to see incredible differences as well within all the different strands of Christianity, but yet it's just sort of lumped in everybody from sort of Bible-only evangelicals to Episcopalians who are actually Christians, to Roman Catholics, to Eastern Orthodox. All of those people accept the four Gospels. They don't accept these other Gospels. But there's all these other, I don't know, there's all these other differences, and it's just interesting how they paint the winning party as just this sort of monolithic beast that just shuts down anything that's different.
Yeah, like parts of the church that divided radically from each other both have those four Gospels.
Wouldn't it be true that, you know, the Christians, the early church, would have known who wrote the four Gospels, you know, themselves? In other words, been there when it was done, some of the early Christians, and been able to know just by that, by passing down the authentic documents.
Yeah, I mean that it's a little more complicated, it's a more complex picture than that, especially when you think of the fact that so Jesus died somewhere in the early 30s, and Paul starts writing maybe in the 40s, 40s or 50s, and Mark isn't written until the 60s. So there's this big
Anyway,
I was going to say, I don't...
Well, what about at that point, though? I mean, once
I think
from that point on they would be passed down.
I think so. I think, and like I tried to highlight tonight, I think there's like when you look just at the substance of the teaching, at what it's saying, they're very different. They're in different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
I'm just wondering if that's another way that, I mean, is it likely that that would have been the case?
I think so. That's sort of why I thought to set it up sort of that way, or partly to set it up, just to sort of look at how they sort of, they're in different universes.
Besides the fact that God himself is able to reveal to the world what he wants, you know, the truth. Anyway, God himself ordained these things, and we have to be able to trust God that he was able to do that, to provide for us the truth. See what I'm saying?
I think so.
The man thing, the God thing.
Yeah. Any questions?
I was just going to say, Ben's comment about how, like, the Gnostic gospel seems just so like a different religion. And I was just thinking when you were talking, I haven't read it, but you were talking about the content, and just you mentioned a couple things about it. Just seemed there was a lot that's secretive, you know, that there are people who sort of know things that God told them that nobody else knows, and just how esoteric it is, and you hear it, and it's like, what does this even mean? And that just strikes me as standing in like a pretty stark opposition to the four gospels that we have, where Jesus really came to bring clarity,
mm-hmm.
to bring knowledge,
and publicly, yeah.
publicly, and even the way that he, you know, he is described as the light and the one by which we see, and just the movement towards greater knowledge, a deeper understanding. Yes, there's still an acknowledgement that the God of the Bible is a God of mystery.
Yeah.
And there is a level of mystery there, but it's not, Jesus was many things, but secretive.
Yeah.
Isn't really one of them.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, well, he talks in parables, whatever, but he used parables, but he's trying to make a very clear point, I think, in my reading of it. And I think even, you know, the point about kind of linking that onto the Old Testament, that sort of, that God could have just sent Jesus initially. But Jesus came at a very specific point in time in history, you know, and was the culmination of this law. And
mm-hmm.
and again, like you, I mean, that's part of the beauty of it, is you see the Old Testament, so many pieces pointing to him, and it's a to me, it's kind of a, like this, a marching towards
mm-hmm.
a greater knowledge and a deeper knowledge,
yeah.
and a greater ability to see, which will be ultimately fulfilled when Jesus returns
yeah.
in New Jerusalem. But that, I just kept thinking about that in contrast just to the
conversation
about sort of confusion, secrets, and this person knows this, but they don't share it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so other qualitatively
yeah.
from what we see in the
yeah.
four Gospels
yeah.
and how they link
yeah.
to the whole narrative.
Yeah, you saying that, like, I looked at this verse in 1 John 1:18 where it talks about no one has ever seen God but the one and only Son, who is himself God. And then closest relationship with the Father, he has made him known. That made him known, it literally means like Jesus exegeted the Father for it. Like the word we get for exegesis, which is sort of how you draw meaning out of a text, especially biblical text, is Jesus exegetes God the Father for us. He explains what God the Father is like.
New American Standard says he has explained him.
Oh, really? Yeah. Got to kick this NIV to the curb. Yeah.
I do understand some not invented, not inspired version, right?
I'm not. That's next week's lecture. Well, Bible translation jokes are always good around here. Yeah. Anyone else have a comment who hasn't, or a question or anything, or, I can, either end of this row right here, both hands are up.
Just that, there's one of these Gospels, probably more than one, who made fun of the disciples and things, they called them, but he's a murderer and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, Christianity was struggling for acceptance to the in these world. If anyone
yeah.
was at all Christian, they wouldn't write things like that. They would work against the thing that
yeah.
they were all
yeah, 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 yeah.
Even the heretic
Christians were struggling with have their
Yeah, it's the Gospel of Judas, and Judas is really really going after the teaching of the church. Wants to make, I mean, in part that's why Judas is the hero, right? In the other Gospels, Judas is the one who betrays Jesus, and basically in this, the apostles, who then become the source of the church's teaching, apostolic teaching, the disciples, the apostles, are the ones who don't get Jesus. And Jesus wants to disassociate himself. Like when they're having the Eucharist, he's talking about worshiping your God. And he mocks them and he distances himself from them. So it's a presentation of the church as just buffoons. So yeah, that one's really, really, really antagonistic. I don't know. But yeah, angry. So did you ever yeah, that's what Matthew, I think Matthew calls him that in that. Yeah, he's asking him, which, you know, really, Thomas, in the Gospel of Thomas, Thomas is sort of presented as the one who gets the secret knowledge. So it's not as though the Gospel of Thomas is saying that, that Peter and Matthew are right. I mean, there's a similar, account where Jesus says, "Who do you say that I am?" To his disciples, and then Peter is the one who says, "You are the Christ, you are the Son of God." And then right after, I wouldn't necessarily. I mean, I'm just not as much of a. I don't totally have a perfect grasp on the Gospel of Thomas to know if. My impression would be that. Them saying this, they're mistaken, but Thomas is mistaken because Thomas can't, or Thomas is right when they're mistaken because Thomas is the one who can't even say anything about who God is because he can't say a word. And if he does.
It does sound like someone that, what does it say, that he who says that Christ Jesus came from God.
Are you talking about 1 John? It talks about
anyone who confesses.
Who doesn't say that Jesus came in the flesh?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Spirit. Like, yeah.
You can't say anything about Christ.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
The other thing is, what's the point of isolated illumination? Just for him to know and nobody else? But that's not how God.
I mean, I think it appeals to a lot of people because then, the gospel is so like. In the New Testament Gospels, Jesus says the kingdom of God is among you, is amongst you. It's moving, it's doing something. And sometimes it's mistranslated to say the kingdom of God is within you. But in the Gospel of Thomas, it says the kingdom of God is in you. So basically, you just need to look into yourself. You don't need Jesus to die on the cross. Jesus doesn't die on the cross in almost any of these Gospels.
That's a new age teaching.
Well, it's an old age teaching,
yeah,
too. But I think it appeals to modern people because you don't need other people, you don't need community, you don't need rules, you can sort of choose your own adventure, no one can tell you you're wrong, and you have perfect access to God.
You have everything you need, it's right inside of you.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways that sounds really nice, you know? I mean, until I spend time looking at myself and then I'm like, I don't really want this. But I think a lot of people find it appealing. So I think it does, especially in our day and age. I think kind of makes sense to a lot of people. And then so we talk, we have to have a different discussion. I think there's more to talk about.
15 years. That's, what I'm talking about. 15 years. People believe what they want to believe. They see teachers have to teach where they want to hear.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. All right, last one.
So, the historical aspect of Christianity, these apocryphal gospels totally are devoid of it and nor in divorcement. But Christianity is first and foremost an historical religion that is other religions. Even Islam, it was visions of one guy that an angel gave him. Buddhism, it's not, Hinduism, etc. If you want to disprove Christianity, you disprove the historicity of it. The Judeo-Christian faith is an historical faith. And I think that is what part of what Metzger was getting about, not just that it has supernatural power, but that it has authenticity for concrete reasons. And if I could just read verse 1 of Luke, it brings this out. Of the four Gospels, Luke, for example, says that regarding the historic element, now I have undertaken to compile an account, many have undertaken to compile an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, like the accounts passed on to us by those who were eyewitnesses and servants of the word from the beginning. So it seems good to me as well, because I have followed all things carefully from the beginning to write an orderly account. It's extremely historical. It's something that happened in a time and a place, and it's verifiable. And that is what gives Christianity its relevance, its impact, its power, because it happened, and it happened in history, and it happened in cultural setting. And Christ, God came to earth to be man and to live among us, and it's real. It's not just somebody's revelation, somebody's ideas or philosophy.
Or vision,
yeah.
All right. Anybody else? If not, we could call it a night. Oh, yes, ma'am.
I just want to make one comment, bouncing off of what Daniel said, and the difference between Christianity and, I don't even want to call Christianity a religion, that's a technical term, I suppose. But the total difference between Christianity and world religions is that none of the others offer a personal relationship with God. Mm-hmm. Christianity is a relationship with the God of the universe who loves us and we can give him back. That's not any world religion. They're man's efforts to try to reach God their own way. Mm-hmm. But God, in his sovereignty and in his wisdom, has started from Genesis and he's run that thread right through to Revelation. But he's the author of the story. That's why it's the four Gospels and none of the others, because God said, that's not in my book, because he inspired and he's ordering everything.
Yeah.
Just so.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a good note to call it a night. So thank you all for coming out.
Thank you.
Yeah.